So with that scripture reading then, we'll pass the evening over to Sean Snowden, who's going to speak to us on the topic, A Divided World. Sean, please.
Well, thanks Mike, and good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. I just wanted to say at the outset that I'm going to try to make this interactive. So if you would like to, you can keep your microphone on. I've got a few questions to ask, and there'll be some opportunity to speak and maybe answer some of those questions. So let's just start, with this, with the first slide here. You know, I hope you're all comfortable and sitting on your couch in your dining room, living room, or at the kitchen here like I am. Maybe you've got a coffee, maybe you've got some snacks. I've got lots of Fisherman Friends and some water to hold back the coughing fits. So I guess there's some advantages to, meeting online like this, as we can have some of the comforts of home, but I still miss the energy of live interaction, and hopefully, and God willing, we'll get an opportunity to get back to that soon. I'm generally a curious person. I suppose that's one of the reasons why I've decided to get into the building inspection business. You have to be curious about a house in order to do a good job of inspecting it, I think. And I'm curious about other things as well. I'm curious about current events and the things that are going on in the world. And I try to keep up on local provincial, national, international, global events. And, when I read the news or when I watch something, when I try to understand an event or some political motivations, I find myself almost on a daily basis asking what in the world is going on with this world. You know, we've had presentations in the past, and we will in the future from this virtual platform, I suppose, on politics and Bible prophecy related to politics and current events. And that's really one of the things we're going to look at here tonight as well. But if I was to look at current events in the last, number of months, certainly the last couple of years, and try to understand, is there a theme? Is there a consistent theme that's happening in the world that we could speak to? And I would say, sadly, it is division and conflict. You just have to listen to one newscast, certainly from what's going on down south, and you start to get a very real sense that there is division all over the world. And although we have this announced that this is, this talk is called What in the World is Going On, in reality, what we want to discuss is this divided world. So my topic is going to be to look at these different aspects. And for those of us who are students of the Bible, even if you're just students of global politics, you should be curious about what's happening in the world. And I think you'll also find this theme running through most things. And I think we have to be curious. We have to be curious as Bible students for a number of reasons. First, we live in this world. We live and breathe in it, and we have to care about what's happening in this world, because oftentimes it affects us. It certainly affects other people, and we should care about other people. And second, we need to be curious, because as Bible believers, we know there is a better future. We know God has a plan, this future on the horizon, and we need to see the signs that are happening in the world to help us understand and appreciate that future. And maybe even get a sense of when it's going to happen. Now, as I mentioned, I've got some questions to ask. And if you feel up to it, you can certainly try to answer. If not, that's totally fine. If you got a noisy house, you may want to, keep it muted. But I'm hoping that we can kind of stay awake through this process with asking a few questions. And the reason I say it's important to understand the signs, it was important even back in the time of Christ. Now, look at this verse up on the screen. The Lord Jesus Christ is speaking to those around him, those that followed him, and of course his disciples were always present with him. And he was frustrated oftentimes because, people around him kept asking for signs. And in a lot of cases, they just wanted to be fed. They just wanted to see a miracle. But Christ was speaking and preaching and giving parables, but also telling them the things that would shortly come to pass. And he's quoted here in Matthew 16 as saying, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, you say, it'll be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening." And the Lord says, "You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times." And And we'd find the same thing. We can look outside and we can tell by what's going on in the weather what the day is going to be like tomorrow. We might even understand certain events are going to happen. But what Christ is telling them at the time, some 2,000 years ago, and also telling us today, is we have to be aware of the things that are going on in this world. We have to be aware of the signs. We need to be able to interpret these signs so we can understand how God's plan is unfolding. And as I mentioned at the outset, one of the big signs that I believe I'm seeing, and I think you probably are too, is that it's growing divided. And not just because of what we see down south. And we had a great lecture last week, and we looked at the history of the U.S. political process and the things that are going down there with the election. We'll talk a little bit about that tonight. But we're becoming divided in society, locally and globally, in a myriad of different ways and on all kinds of different subjects. So here's the first question. What do you feel we're divided on? Or do you see that sense of division in your own, you know, community? Or do you see it in the world? Anyone care to answer? Anyone?
I'd say politics, especially in the States.
Divisive politics. Absolutely. Thanks for that. Yeah, I know. I mean, I definitely see that. And we're going to talk a little bit about divisive politics tonight. Anything else that you guys are seeing? We're going to show a bunch of examples. This is not a right or wrong answer. Maybe you don't see anything going on in your local area. And that's great if you don't see division. Anyone else? Well, let's look at a few of these things. You know, in what ways do you feel divided? Well, I'm going to tell you some of the ways that I feel divided from other people, from society, and look at some global ways that people are talking about societal division. We're divided because of COVID-19. Now, here's just a great photograph of somebody, you know, washing a plexiglass shield. Everywhere we go now, if we're going out to shop or we're going out to even buy a coffee, we're divided by plexiglass barriers. And that's for a reason, so that there's less of a chance of, you know, the transfer of these, you know, viral particles. We're even divided tonight when you think about it. I mean, we're all here collectively online, but we're divided by technology because we can't see each other. We can't talk to each other live and in person. We have to do it through this technology. Now, these are minor and short-term divisions for sure, and really may not cause a lot of problems. But if you've been watching what's going on in the news just locally in Victoria, you'll notice that we're divided over this homeless situation. Right? It's been a primary topic all year. If you're reading newspaper, you're listening to news talk radio, you're looking at things on social media, the homeless problem in Victoria is very real. It's very big. It's pervading the downtown. There's growing tensions among residents, among businesses about what the city of Victoria is doing or not doing about it. In fact, ironically, or maybe not, in the Times columnist just a couple of months ago, there was an article, and the title of the article was, "Don't Let the Challenge of Homelessness Divide Us," because it is a very divisive issue in this particular city. But this too is not a major problem. It's not creating, you know, protests and issues in downtown Victoria. Well, next, you know, are these new COVID-19 restrictions? We went through it a number of months ago. We're back into it again. We can't have live meetings at our local ecclesia because of it. We're back to our own specific core bubble. Now, I'm not saying it's causing infighting among us, but it's certainly creating issues amongst people out there. I mean, we don't see the protests, the anti-mask protests or the anti-lockdown protests in Victoria. And even it's pretty rare in BC, but they're seeing it in Ontario. They're seeing it in Quebec. So it's a problem in Canada. And certainly this is a problem in other parts of the world. Some of those protests actually become violent. I mean, we get along pretty well here on Vancouver Island. But in other parts of the world, and even in this nation, we see people divided over how we're reacting to or what we're going to do about this COVID-19 issue. There's conspiracy theories out there where people say it's a hoax. The government's just making it up so they can control us. So these are very divisive topics for us as well. If you think about the election that happened just last year in Canada, that was very divisive. Not just in the sense that we're split basically into three parties, almost one third Liberal Conservative and a smaller portion to the NDP, and then everybody else, you know, the other parties are relatively small. we're not just split into political parties and how people vote, but we're divided on things like the environment and the economy and pipelines and languages and First Nations rights and increasingly this left versus right political ideology that Josh brought up. This used to be really just a divisive issue down in the United States, but now we're seeing it up here in Canada. But it even, to me, is even worse than that. As I mentioned last week, we had a Bible talk on the U.S. election. Now, the U.S. is a very divided nation. And so I asked myself, well, what in the world is going on down there? I see this country almost ripping apart. This almost 50-50 split in voting, it's made worse because it's a two-party, effectively a two-party system in the U.S. You have just a little bit more than 50% of the popular vote went to the conservatives and just a little bit less went to the Republicans, Biden and Trump. And it's not just about Joe Biden as a conservative and Trump as a Republican. They're divided on pretty much every single major issue politically that you can get. You name it. Abortion, building walls, wearing masks, the economy, the racial divide, Medicare, handling the pandemic. They're divided on all of these issues and more. And not just the politicians, we see it in the American people. You know, you either vote for the left or you vote for the right. There's kind of no middle ground. You have a sitting president right now in Donald Trump that's totally unconventional. And then in some ways that's great. He's done some unconventional things. But in other ways, he's created an atmosphere where what used to be common sense is now just nonsense. I mean, really, when you think about it, he's the epitome of those that call evil good and good evil. And he's not conceding the election. And he's trying to fight it. And that's creating problems. And so we're seeing violence and protest marches and people getting injured and in some cases killed as a result of these divisions and conflicts that result from all of these issues. The U.S., many experts say, this is not just me, many experts say is in trouble. And they need to find a path through it. They're a divided nation. But they're not the only ones. Increasingly, we're living in this global universe that is divided. Over the past number of years, you might have seen this rise of nationalism. It's seen almost everywhere and in almost every form, all over the Asian continent, all over the European continent. You know, sure, we saw it in the election of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a nationalist. He's a protectionist. We saw it in the UK a couple of years ago with Brexit. Right. We have this fight between those that want to preserve the national aspects of the UK, nationalistic policies in Asian countries and in the European Union. We're seeing changing their societies. The outcome in a lot of these countries who are moving to the right politically, and we're seeing these right wing parties, they call it, becoming increasingly more powerful in some nations and now gaining rulership. These nationalist policies, they're tightening their hold on things like the traditional culture of that nation, the traditional languages, the core ethnicities, right? So, you know, you hear about white supremacists. Well, you know, in some of these European nations, those people who were born German and of Germanic descent are looking at those who are not and saying, wait a second, you don't belong here. And this leads to less tolerance in those countries. And less tolerance to anything that's not quintessentially German or French or Austrian. And this promotes opposition to immigration, religion, and it also, in a lot of cases, forms a more aggressive attitude politically to their national neighbors. And we see that as well. You know, at its worst, nationalism and racism often collide. And that divide, the outcome of that divide, is gruesome because you have genocide. Now, the most obvious horror of genocide takes us back to the Second World War, the Holocaust of the Jews, and a number of other nationalities and other peoples who just happened to be different from those of the Nazi regime. You know, and that happened a long time ago, but genocide is a modern horror as well. Just think in the last few decades, Darfur, Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia, Cambodia, Armenia, just in the last couple of years, Myanmar, which used to be Burma, with the persecution and attempted genocide of what's called the Rohingya people, who are primarily Muslims. I mean, that's been happening for the last couple of years right before our very eyes. You know, those kind of divisions that lead to that kind of horror, the ultimate division and the ultimate hatred of one group or type of people against another. And as I mentioned, this is sadly not an issue of some past barbaric generation. This is a current issue of this current generation. This is the outcome of a world that just can't get along, and nations that are divided even within themselves. And this is leading to an increase in a lot of things, including protests. You may wonder to yourself, why are we reading so much and hearing so much about protests? Pretty much every newscast you go to is going to commentate on some protest somewhere in Canada, in the U.S., around the world. And this rise in protests where you have essentially two opposing sides come together, or one side is against the government or against the authorities, and they end up yelling at each other and sometimes fighting, and there's no dialogue, there's no conversation, there's no debate, there's only division. And it seems like these things are expanding globally. Well, interestingly, just last year, Global News here in BC ran a series on the rise and expansion of protests. And they state that they are happening more, they are expanding, and they are going more and more global. And these protests are well funded. And they're driven by not, you know, tens or hundreds of disaffected people, but by thousands and tens of thousands of people. And there's a number of reasons why these things are happening. So it says in this Global News report, number one, we're seeing more protests because there's just more protests, because there's more to protest about. People are more divided and they want a voice, and they feel that the only voice that is really listened to is a voice of protest. The second reason that this news story brought out is protesters have become more emboldened to march and to fight in protest because they see other protests actually making change happen. An example of that was what happened with the Arab Spring that started back in October of 2010. Many countries in the Middle East, these protests that launched, that were essentially democratic protests against dictatorships, actually toppled governments. And so they actually had meaningful outcomes. The third reason why Global News said there is a rise in global protests is there's more coverage of protests around the world. More coverage in the news, traditional news, more coverage in social media. So we actually see it more. So there's more of them. They're getting more coverage. And so we see more. And that spurs more to happen. It's very cyclical and self-promoting. It's like, hey, that group is protesting their rights. Well, why not us? Especially because they're getting their way and things are actually happening. The fourth reason is because social media has made it very easy to organize marches and protests. And that means locally. You can go on Facebook or Instagram, or you can go on whatever social media platform you use, and you can broadcast out protest in this place at this time, you know, bring these things, typically fireworks, and off they go. And those protests can be coordinated and organized around the world. And we're seeing mass rallies that are being coordinated in hours, literally in hours, where you'll get 10,000, 50,000 people into a square in a major city, all because social media has made that possible. And the fifth reason why these commentators state that people today are protesting more and why we're seeing more protests is because society is generally less willing to suffer through issues of wrongdoing, and they're less willing to deal with the societal pressures, and so they fight back. You know, it used to be the saying, and you know, this is before my time, I suppose, you know, I'll have my day in court, or I'll see you in court. Right, that's where things were hammered out. We're in the courts of the land. Now it's basically, we'll just take it to the streets. Now that can be good, right? Like in the case where people are really fighting for real injustice, and they're trying to change things. And it can be bad when two opposing sides, you know, square off in some political debate, like down in the U.S. They fight and sometimes kill each other because they just don't happen to agree on politics. You know, think about the major protest movements of just the last 10 years. And, you know, we mentioned the Arab Spring, which started in 2010. But just since then, I'm talking about major protest movements that were global in nature, that had multi-million dollars in funding. Arab Spring, the Occupy Wall Street movement, remember that, where large groups of people would just go and occupy buildings, government buildings, corporate buildings, in order to get changes in their governance. Extinction Rebellion, Black Lives Matter, of course, is probably the one most talked about. The Umbrella Movement in Hong Kong, just started happening about 3 years ago, protesting, you know, the way that the Chinese government was imposing more and more stringent orders on the people in Hong Kong. The yellow vest protests that started in France and actually spread around the world. We actually had yellow vest protests in Canada, in Ontario, and primarily Quebec. The Me Too movement. Now there's anti-lockdown protests. There's anti-mask protests. And these are just, you know, the major ones. If you go to Wikipedia and just ask for, you know, the major global protest movements, you actually get thousands of them. And a lot of them you would probably recognize. And many of these causes that bring about protests and people in the streets cause societal upset. Sometimes they cause things to change, but oftentimes they result in violence and even death. Why do these protests happen? Well, because people are divided, because people feel that their governments are not listening to them, because they feel that those that are in ruling authority don't have the power or the care or the ability to do anything about basic or even complex issues. And people are often just against the government in any case. And certainly some countries have had a long history of the citizen against the government and against authorities like the police who come out and try to impose the rule of law. We saw a lot of that, almost, you know, anarchy down in Washington State, just down south of the border, not a couple of hours, you know, from here. And some are just anarchists out trying to have some fun at other people's expense. But the result in many cases is conflict, taking over government buildings, burning small towns up. You know, it's scary to think what can happen when people are divided. You might say, well, okay, Sean, I don't really see this. And as I said earlier, well, my answer to that would be good. I'm glad in your neck of the woods or within your community, you don't see this kind of division. As I said, we don't see it partly because we live in Canada and mostly because we live in Victoria and almost always maybe because we're not looking out there and being curious about what in the world is going on. Maybe some of us don't want to do that because it's depressing and sometimes it's shocking. But don't just take my word for it. And don't just take, you know, some of these slides word for it. A major international survey company thought about the same question and they asked this same question. Is your country divided? Some of you may know the name of the company. It's Ipsos. In Canada, they used to call it Ipsos Reid. It's gone through a number of different variations over the years. But in 2018, Ipsos went out to 20,000 people in 27 countries and ask them a series of questions related to things like, is your country divided? And how is your country divided? And why is your country divided? Now, here's another question for the audience. If you still have your microphone unmuted. What do you think the percentage response was of these 20,000 people in 27 countries, their response when they were asked the question, is your country divided? Is it 15% of people responded that way? Was it 20? Is anybody out there?
80%.
80%.
80.
Who said 80%?
Bonnie.
Bonnie. You know what? That's amazing. I was going to bring prizes for tonight, I'm getting a little bit of feedback there. But that's amazing because it's actually 76%. 76% of people globally believe that their country is divided. Ironically, I guess you could say, one thing that people are not divided on is the fact that we're divided. And this survey is very extensive and it goes through a lot of different things. But I think those results are staggering. That on average of these 27 countries, 20,000 people responded and said, yes, our country is divided. And almost every single case of those surveyed stated that their country was more divided than it was even 10 years ago. Let's just look at some of the stats. You think, well, you know, Canada, we're probably not that divided, right? We're probably, you know, lower in the bottom of the scale. Well, that's actually not true. Take a look at this. And here's the U.S. and Canada. So some countries like Serbia, they're the highest. 93% of people in Serbia say that their country is divided. And some of them at the bottom, like Saudi Arabia, interestingly, 34%. China, very interestingly, 48%. Canada's up there, 62%. So more than half the people in Canada say that our nation is divided. The U.S., 84%. But look, a lot of those countries in the European nations are very high percentage of their citizens say that their country is divided. So what did this survey determine were the issues that separated us? Now, Josh mentioned when I asked the first question that we're divided politically. So anyone else want to sort of comment before I throw the top five up? The number one is political divide. But what are some of the other reasons why in this survey it came out that people in different countries feel that they're divided or topics that we're divided over? Anyone want to take a guess?
Religious divide.
Yes, absolutely. That's in the top five. Anyone else?
Financial divide.
Actually, yes, financial divide. So rich versus poor. We're almost got the whole list here. Anyone else want to take a crack at it?
Immigration.
Immigration. That sounded like Dan Clover. Immigration's in the top five. You know, let's just put it up here. Thanks for those answers. Political views. So political ideology is the number one thing that the respondents came back and said, this is what we're divided on, right? And that's not surprising, right? That the highest tensions would be between people of different political views. And many countries have only, you know, two or three party systems, and that creates a lot of tension in and of itself. But, you know, it was the top tension in actually 14 of the countries by a high percentage, including Canada and the U.S. It was their number one.
I'm surprised there's a difference between ethnicities and immigration reasons.
Yeah, the second one was mentioned. I think that was... Just have to get you guys to mute. But thanks for the background commentary. Money and wealth. So the divide between rich and poor is the next highest tension. Issues like the distribution of wealth and fairness in the economy and what, you know, the fact that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. The third tension was between immigration and citizens in individual countries. Now, this is where nationalism rears up. Like those countries polling the highest on these issues were in Europe. And yes, they've had a lot of issues with immigration, immigrants coming in from war-torn countries, like from Libya and from Iraq and from Syria predominantly coming into the country. And that's causing societal pressures. And there's, when you have a massive influx of people from a particular kind of culture and a particular language and a particular ethnicity, that can cause issues, especially when they're ghettoized in certain neighborhoods. And we've seen that. We've seen it in the UK. We've seen it in France. We've seen it in Germany. And that also causes the rise of these nationalistic sentiments and white supremacist parties who come to the fore and say, wait a second, we got to stop these people coming in. So third was immigration and race. Fourth mention was religious differences. And often that's related to number three, right? Religious differences. And so in Canada, we coexist, I think, you know, fine between the different, you know, core religious groups. But in Asia and in Middle Eastern countries, they do not. Many of those countries in Asia and the Middle East actually only have one official religion, and other religions, you know, might be persecuted. And religious differences foment a lot of conflict, including war. Now, rounding out the top five was different ethnicities. So I think our answers covered all five of these. And again, these differences, if left unchecked or they're not supported or promoted by political leaders, they end up tearing a country apart. So these are the five main reasons why people in these 27 countries felt that their nations were divided. It's not, you know, it's not shocking that you guys in the audience got all five, because I think we can see those are obvious or can be obvious issues. If people aren't willing to be tolerant and aren't willing to look at people who are different, but treat them the same as we would want to be treated ourselves. This gentleman here, Cliff Young, who is the president of Ipsos Public Affairs, made this particular comment. Actually, read his whole comment. It's very interesting because he says things like it's not shocking that humans can act like this or humans can feel this, almost like a statement on human nature. But he says, overall, there's been a decline in trust in traditional institutions and a rise in the belief that the system is broken. Young tells U.S. News, citizens in general no longer believe that governments, politicians, and other institutions can deliver on their promises. And he goes on to say a number of other very interesting things about the state of nations and how it's getting more and more divisive. And that is why the response was so striking when they sent out those particular surveys. So the question is then, we understand that people are divided, and we can see, you know, what are some of the common issues that divide one human from another, one nation from another, one ethnicity from another. But why are we like that? Why are humans like this? Why are we so divisive, almost by nature? You know, you could say, and you'd be right, that mankind has always been divided and has always seen conflict and has always seen, you know, hatred. And that would absolutely be true historically. You know, while humanity can be credited with doing, you know, good things to one another, definitely the sad catalog of human history is filled with division and conflict. From the beginning of mankind to today, we've always struggled to get along. But with all this knowledge that we have and all the technology that we espouse and the generations of experience and all of the studies and witnessing the cause and effect of human interactions, why are we not able to resolve this most basic of human functions? Why are humans so fundamentally divided? Well, as you can imagine, there's been lots of studies on this as well, and I've gone through and read a couple of them. Now, here's some interesting things. The first thing that I want to bring up is a number of years ago, the Max Planck Institute in Germany conducted an experiment with a group of toddlers, young children, with their parents. And the children were placed in a room with these adults, and the adults were told to drop things on the floor, and the children were encouraged to pick them up for them. And this they happily did. They worked collectively. They almost turned it into a fun game. And that went on almost in perpetuity. The adults would drop something on the floor, the children would pick it up, and they would bring it back, and everyone was happy. Then, in this study, a reward was introduced to the children. It was given to the child who handed the item back to the adult. Now, anyone want to guess what immediately happened? Anyone? Anyone listening?
They started fighting.
Sounds like Mike. Yeah, it's exactly what happened. You know, almost immediately, the group work that they had been working on immediately broke down. Harmony was completely shattered, and the children began fighting over the item that was to be retrieved. And they fought over the reward that they were to get. They challenged each other. Well, I helped you bring it halfway back to the table. I spotted it first, and I told you about it. They immediately started a fight. Their behavior had been totally corrupted, conditioned by some kind of reinforcement. The reinforcement was that when they went to pick up the item and they brought it back, they would get remuneration. They would get a gift. They would get an incentive. And the effect of that incentive and the reinforcement of that product, that process, the effect of it was competition, social division, and conflict. As humans, we get along until there's something at stake. And we fight when there's something to fight over. And what that's called is sociological and psychological conditioning. And this was a big study that this institute came up with to try to understand why humans' behavior is different in one situation to the next when the only variable was some kind of a reinforcement. Well, the second thing that that experts have come up with is society in general influences, especially in the last 20 years, the societal influence is now to focus on self. It wasn't really the case, especially in Western, more sort of Christianized countries, you know, in the 40s, 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s, and even into the 1960s, where there was still a lot of biblical influence. And it was all about doing things for other people. But in the last 20 years, society has really shifted. So on top of this sociological conditioning, organizations and think tanks are learning that increasingly the influence of society and sort of the self-help mantra is to focus on you. Now, it seems great. It even seems logical. Some people, you know, there's this catchphrase, you can't help others until you've helped yourself first. You know, but it's backwards. Because in this particular issue, in this kind of sort of Me Too generation, where we're taught to speak our own truth, we've heard that terminology, you need to speak your own truth and work out your own health and your own well-being, that we've gone to a me first generation. And that me first means at the expense of others, and that causes division. If I'm going to just care about the things that I want to do and I want to do first, then the things that I do are more important, and the things that you do on the other side of the conversation, the other side of the dialogue, the other side of the fence are less important. And there you go. You have a division. So we'll call that societal influences to focus on self. And the third thing is all about social media. Social media creates thought silos. So as a global society, we're being conditioned to be divided, especially as we cocoon ourselves in a world of social media, which is even worse when the entire world is locked down in a pandemic and our means of communication are traditionally social media. Zoom is a form of social media. But we're also talking about Instagram and TikTok and Facebook and all these other programs where we communicate and we share images and thoughts and stories, and we also consume things like news. We're increasingly, through those platforms, only listening to opinions that we agree with. Now, for sure, if we look historically at the way we consume news, which was primarily through newsprint and then television, that there were conservative stations and there were liberal stations. There were conservative newsprint and there were liberal newsprint. And for sure, you got a slightly different ideology coming out of those. But generally speaking, they spoke the news. But social media news and views are packaged up and sent to users based on their likes and their interests. Now, Marty and I, and I know a number of you out there, recently watched a documentary called The Social Dilemma. And if you haven't been able to watch it, or you're concerned in some way about social media and you want to watch it, please do, because what it brought out in this realm was actually very scary. It's very easy to get locked into a social media group like a Facebook chat group that spits out the very same views that you have. You love that. Everybody loves to hear that they're right. But when you only hear one side of the argument, the result is intolerance. And hiding behind a screen is generally cause people to be less civil and speak in ways that are more hateful than if we were face to face. So that's on top of that. So if you add these three things together, sociological and psychological conditioning to compete, societal influences to focus on self, and then this issue of social media creating silos of opinions and thoughts, these three things together are a very toxic mix. And so it's no wonder we have growing tensions. It's no wonder we have racial divides and political violence and a growing feeling in the world that we're living in, that it's very divided, because all of these things cause us to be more distrustful and more opinionated and less civil and less tolerant of other people. Question is, back to the statement that the Lord Jesus Christ made and we read at the start, is this a sign of things to come? Well, interestingly, we always bring out the opinion of the Bible, of course, because we believe that it is always speaking truth. And there's some very interesting prophecies about this particular topic, and I just want to look at one of them tonight. And that is that about 2,600 years ago, the Bible predicted a world in which there was going to be no unity. No unity between nations and no unity between peoples. The Bible actually predicted 2,600 years ago a future world that was going to be divided. And we're going to look at the prophecy of Daniel. Yep, the same Daniel that went into the lion's den. And he wrote a little bit over 600 years before the time of Christ. And he was writing with divine inspiration. And he was writing at a very interesting time in ancient history. So we're going to go back in time. We're going to do just a little short burst here. Just a little bit of history. I won't make you suffer through a ton of history, but if you go back in time, about 2500 BC, Egypt started before then, but in and around 2500 BC, Egypt had become the dominant nation in the world. Now, they also continue to be, the oldest surviving nation in history, and that's very interesting as well. They're still around, of course, today, not with the same level of dominance, of course. And there were other nations. There were hundreds of other nations at the time, but Egypt was very formalized and very well managed and very well ruled. And so they dominated the world, at least in that region, for almost 500 years. And the next major nation to come along was Assyria. And they were the first nation of influence that actually superseded and even ruled parts of Egypt for a time. And when they were at their peak, at their zenith, they took over much of what we would now say is the Middle East, from the Mediterranean all the way down around to the Persian Gulf, in this huge arc that went way up into modern-day Turkey. And in 721 BC, as they were going around subduing nations, they took the nation of Israel into captivity. Now, we know that from secular history, and we also know that from the biblical narrative. And shortly after that, a few years later, 57 years later, the sister nation to Israel, which was Judah, because they'd become a divided people into two nations, they were taken captive by the emerging nation of Babylon. And so the time that we're focusing on is in this time when Israel was taken captive, and the time of the king of Babylon, which was King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, we all know who Nebuchadnezzar was. We know him from history, and we know him from our biblical understanding. And the time frame that Nebuchadnezzar ruled was around 606 to about 536 BC, or at least that was the time of the dominance of the nation of Babylon. Now, it's important to speak to the nation of Israel being part of this process in history and in the narrative of the Bible, of course, because the Old Testament is really focused on the nation of Israel. They're God's chosen people, and because they rebelled against God, and they came back, and they rebelled, and they came back, and they rebelled again, that ultimately God told them he was going to put them into captivity, and he did. They went into Assyria, and then the other half went into Babylon. So here we are at this time, and the book of Daniel is writing about this time, and this man Daniel was a young prince of the Jewish people, so he came in with the captives, he was taken prisoner, and as they often did in these ancient nations, they would find those of the nation that they'd taken over and find those that were smart and well referred to and brought them into the ranks of governments, partly because, you know, the nation that took them captive wants to learn about those cultures, but also it allowed them to maybe rule their own people. So there's a lot of political reasons why they would do that. And Daniel was a smart young man. He believed in God. He was very, very faithful. And so God blessed him, and he rose up in ranks in governance of Babylon. And so we read of this specific event in the Bible. If you don't have your Bible open, grab it and go to the book of Daniel in chapter 2. We're going to read a number of passages from Daniel chapter 2 and try to understand how this relates to what's going on in the world today. Daniel chapter 2. So hopefully we're all understanding what time frame we're looking at here and the nations that we're dealing with. So in chapter 2 of the book of Daniel, verse 1, it starts out, and it says, in the second year of the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. And so if we read the record, the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar has, it freaked him out, honestly, and he wanted to try to understand it and understand what it meant. And so he asked his magicians and astrologers and diviners and those people that populated his courts to not only tell him the dream, but also interpret the dream, and they couldn't. Verse 15, there's some dialogue he has with these soothsayers and astrologers, and he gets upset with them, and he commands them all to be destroyed because they couldn't answer the question. So he thought, okay, well, you guys are useless. We're just going to wipe you out. Word gets out to Daniel, this young Jewish prince, and he prays to God, and he gathers three young men with him, and they prayed to God about this matter. And as the text bears out, God gives Daniel the interpretation of the dream. And he then asks to go before the king of Babylon. So that's kind of the setup of what's happening here. And so if we continue on in the narrative, the record tells us down in verse 31 what this dream was. And I'll just read from verse 31 to verse 35. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of the image was of fine gold, and its chest and arms were of silver. Its middle and its thighs were of bronze. And there in verse 33, it says, and its legs were of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And so this dream was about this incredible image, this huge statue. And it's a man with all the different parts of the body represented by different kinds of metal and material. So that was interesting. Daniel was able to tell the king what his dream was about, but what did it mean? And what was the image representing? Well, if we go back to the timeline and we look at, you know, we got Daniel chapter 2 still open, but Daniel's interpretation of the dream was like this. This was a vision of the future table of nations. And Daniel, speaking to King Nebuchadnezzar, said that you are the head of gold. And Babylon was a glorious ancient nation, and gold really represented that nation. Apparently gold was so common, it was almost like the streets were paved with it. And so in this interpretation of the image and of the metals, Babylon was at the top. And then next what we have is Persia. And so Daniel tells the king, another nation would come after you, will defeat Babylon. That happened actually in 536 BC. And so Daniel and history tells us that this nation was the Medo-Persians. And on the image represented with the chest and the arms of silver, and we of course recognize Darius and Cyrus the Great as the ruler of that historical great nation. Well, next in this table of nations in this dream, the interpretation of the dream was Greece. So Persia was taken over in 334 BC by Alexander the Great, and we know that from secular history, and he rules a territory even greater than both Babylon and Persia. In the king's dream, Greece is represented by the belly and thighs of brass, and brass was also known to be the chosen metal of Greece. And Alexander the Great expanded his empire, or the empire continued, until about 67 BC, when the Romans took over. And so in the king's dream, the Roman Empire, which started out as a small empire before the time of Christ and started to expand very broadly, and at the time of Christ, as we know, the Romans were ruling the then known world. These two legs, history teaches us, is our understanding that Rome eventually split into two different empires, the Eastern and the Western Empire. And so historically, we know this to be understood, and Daniel's image plays this out. It is not a coincidence also that history calls this period of time at the beginning of the Roman Empire, the Iron Age. And so the Roman legs are made of iron. So Daniel's interpretation spans history from about 606 BC with Babylon coming onto the scene into and well beyond the time of Christ and through to the collapse of the Roman Empire, which really didn't formally disappear till about 1400 or 1500 AD when that empire finally collapsed. So the question is, and back to Daniel's interpretation, what about the feet and toes of the image? In fact, after the fall of the last vestiges of the Roman Empire, because all of these other empires, Babylon was succeeded by Persia, succeeded by Greece, succeeded by the Roman Empire. But what happened after the Roman Empire? The world then, you know, the Roman Empire wasn't taken over by some other major world-beating power. The world was split into many nation states. And so the Roman Empire was not taken over by one dominant nation, but the world became many, many nations. And so we have this depiction in the feet and toes of the image. Now, there's a lot of detail we could look at about specifically who these nations were, but a representation of these 2 feet and these 10 toes, and not only just the feet and the toes of the image, but it's what they're made of. They're made of iron and clay. Now, I'm not an iron worker and I'm not a pottery expert, but I know that iron and clay don't mix together. They don't stick. They don't stay together. And something that's made with bits of iron and bits of clay is ultimately just going to break apart. And so in this image in the dream and in history that comes after the Roman Empire is this modern nation, modern table of nations that we have today, some strong and some very, very weak. And so it says in Daniel 2:41, and as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of the iron shall be in it. And just as you saw the iron mixed with the soft clay, and in the days of these kings, a number of things is going to happen. So Daniel's interpretation of the king's dream talks about this group of nations that come after, of all different sizes, some strong and some weak, toes all mixed up, representing mixed up nations and mixed people that just don't get along. And says in the next verse, those kingdoms, as you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, we're going to read the rest of the interpretation in just a minute. So since then until now, we have this mixture of races, of hundreds of nations, 202 nations by last count in the UN, and these nations are partly strong, like you have the U.S. and China and Russia and Germany and others. And you have some that are very weak, like Bermuda and Estonia and Canada, I guess. And they don't mix. And you want to prove that, just listen to the things that I've just presented, or just go and read up on the things that are happening in the United Nations and follow some of their summits. They can't agree on anything. I believe we're in the days of those kings, a world divided from itself. And even more than that, we are like we saw with the survey, people divided among ourselves. within these nations, just as the prophecy says. They will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And I believe we see that now. A world that cannot hold together is a very dangerous world indeed, and we saw that in the First World War, as those nations could not stay apart from one another and conflict ensued. We saw that in the Second World War. We've seen that in many conflicts since. The world can't hold itself together. The UN can't hold the nations apart. The question is, are we living in this time? Are we living in a time that the prophet Daniel spoke about so many thousands of years ago? It does seem likely to me. I have to rest my voice a bit. So what did the king of Babylon, what was his reaction to Daniel's interpretation of the dream? You know, I mean, he's the most powerful man in the world at the time. You know, did he rage in anger? Did he command Daniel to be struck down with a sword? No, oddly, for this very powerful man, he did none of those things. He actually humbled himself before Daniel, and he gave praise to Daniel's God. And it says there, and the king answered and said to Daniel, truly your God is a God of gods and Lord of lords and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery. And so we live today in this divided world. And if we saw these things unfolding, we've King Nebuchadnezzar was at the start of the unfolding of this interpretation. We're kind of at the end of it. We have a better perspective than he does. And what I want to understand is, what is our reaction, you know, to the unveiling of this prophecy that we're able to witness because of history, this world that we live in, this divided world that God said that would come after all those nations? The question is, well, you know, where are those nations today? Well, I mean, there's just kind of a sliver picture of the ruins of Babylon. They're in Iraq. The gates of Ishtar are in a museum in Germany. Persia as an ancient nation is no more, but the elements remain in the Islamic Republic of Iran. You know, I have a friend that used to work for me years ago. I still keep in touch with him, whose family came from Tehran, and he identifies as a Persian. He still salutes Cyrus the Great every year on what they assume was Cyrus's, you know, birthday. You know, Greece is still a nation today, as is Italy, a small part of the former Roman Empire. So according to the history as we see it, the final elements of the prophecy of Daniel are yet to happen, because in Daniel's interpretation of the dream, you know, these nations, or at least what these nations represent, are to be all destroyed. And yet all these nations effectively still stand today. The image, really effectively, from Daniel's interpretation of the king's dream still stands today on its feet. So the question is, what's predicted to happen? Well, if you read the prophecy as it continues, it says, in the days of those kings. And so at a time in the world when we see this disunity and these divisions, when we see an increasing conflict and social disruption and nations and peoples that are just not holding together, then something's going to happen. And we read that from Daniel again. It says, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. It says there in verse 34, as you look, the stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and it broke them in pieces. And then the iron and the clay and the bronze and the silver and the gold, this reverse order, starting at the feet and going up and including the whole image, all together were broken in pieces, it says in Daniel chapter 2, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So the prophet says, and in the days of those divided nations, there'll be a solution to all the problems. God will intervene and he'll resolve the world's issues by destroying all the things that brought them about. And it says he will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. The nations of man have always come to ruin. They've always fought with one another since the beginning of time. Man just cannot take care of himself. He can't hold himself together. We always ultimately end in conflict and division. And so divine intervention is the only thing that's going to set everything right. And humanity's divisions will be healed and we will live in peace. Humanity has had thousands of years to get things right, to stop wars, to heal divisions, to get along. And sadly, we just haven't been able to do it. And I think we're more divided than ever. I think you know, the evidence that we have in the prophecy that Daniel gives us by divine inspiration is more evident now than maybe at any time in the history of mankind. We have all of these global organizations that are intended to bring peace and prosperity, but they're all ineffective. And as a society, we're being more divided each and every day. And interestingly, I think we could all agree that we all want the same things. If another survey went out asking people, what is it that you want out of life? I'm pretty sure we'd have 76% or more people saying, look, we just want peace and harmony. We want justice for all. We want health and well-being. We want a healthy climate. We want strong relationships with people, not only people in our family and people in our community, but people among different nations. Unity within the diversity that we have in the human race. A sustainable life, I'm sure people would say. Love, peace, and kindness. I'm sure that almost all people on this earth want those things. We all want balance in this world. And that's why people around the world, they join organizations and they join protest movements and political parties and different groups and efforts because they really want to bring these things to play in the world. And I'm not saying that's not a noble cause. What I'm saying is that mankind has demonstrated the inability to effectively change anything. It's either too little too late or it will never be enough to heal the divisions that this world has. And as Bible believers, we want these same things too. We want peace and we want justice and we want love and we want kindness. We want all of these things. And I would say that we try to, I hope that we try to live these things in our daily lives, that we try to live with these principles. It's an actual fact, a command of God that we do. What we differ on, though we might all agree that we want the same things, what we differ on is who's going to accomplish it. What energy will be behind the greatest social movement in the history of mankind? Now, there are things we can do right now, and I want to just look at two different things. We've only got a couple of slides left. First, practically, and then spiritually. Practically, we can be peacemakers in our lives every day, in our relationships, in our families, in our communities. We can show other people what peace is all about. And that is that it is definitely better than division. So we can be peacemakers in our family and in our community. And we can do that in the little things, like not getting into silly arguments about ridiculous things. Or if you see someone getting agitated, you back off, you give them passage, or that we can lift people up instead of putting them down. You know, there are a lot of ways that we can be peacemakers. Here's a couple of great verses. Matthew 7 and 12 says, so whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. Now that's the golden rule. Society has called this the golden rule. It doesn't say golden rule in the Bible, but it's where it comes from. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. I find we don't often practice that because we're in this sort of me first generation. It's like, you know what? I want you to do to me the things that I want done to me. You know, why should I do them to you? But that's not the case. We need to practice being peacemakers with other people. Romans 14 and 19 says, let us pursue what makes for peace and for mutual upbuilding. So those are the things that we should be doing in our community. Those are the things we should be doing within our family. Those are the things we should be doing within our ecclesia to help people, to be peacemakers, and to bring people together instead of fostering people to be divided. Here's another practical thing we can do, and that is to show love and kindness. And this is something that can be very, very difficult to do. But practically, we can show love and kindness to other people in this world. Christians aren't just kind to other Christians. That's ridiculous. In fact, we're commanded to be kind to everyone. Right? We need to reach out and help people, care for each other, especially during this pandemic lockdown where people are lacking basic human contact. Some people aren't able to get out. I mean, who knew, you know, 4 weeks ago we'd be back in lockdown in our communities. You know, it's the little things that we can do to show love and kindness. It's doing things for other people. And for goodness sakes, please don't go out and buy up all the toilet paper because I hear that's happening again. Just be kind and be compassionate and be loving to one another. Call people up, help them out, pick something up for them, drop it off. Here's a couple of great verses. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy or boast. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. That's the kind of love that we need to have. And here we have in 1 John 3 and 18, let us not love in word or in talk, but in deed and in truth. In other words, don't just say that we're going to do things. In fact, don't even say them. Just go do them. Just practice them. Practice love and kindness to other people. Now here's something that's even more important than all of these things. Is we can believe in God's plan for this divided world. You know, it's interesting. You see the image in the background. I think we've all seen pictures of this. This is one of the monuments in the inscriptions that's down at the UN in New York City. And it's interesting because this is, as you can see from the image, a quote that has been, you know, chiseled into their wall from the prophet Isaiah, from the Bible. You have the statue down there that was actually donated by Russia to the United Nations that has this big, huge, powerful man. And he's beating this sword into a plow. Well, this is being depicted as some kind of story that mankind ultimately will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into prunings. But they don't read the whole passage. Turn to Isaiah chapter 2, because we've got to read this passage, just five verses. They only show one. In fact, they only show part of verse 4 up on the wall. And I think it's great that it's there, because we can talk about, you know, some humanistic organization that has a biblical message on their wall. But not a lot of people talking about it. That's why I'm talking about it tonight. But this is what it says up on their wall. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And that's great. It's a beautiful message. Here's what the full verse actually says. Isaiah chapter 2, starting at verse 1. The word that Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall come to pass, verse 2, that in the latter days, that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of mountains. Remember the stone that was cut out of the mountain without human hands that comes down and lands on Nebuchadnezzar's dream? I think they're the same mountain. And this mountain shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it, and many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Verse 4, and he shall judge, God shall judge between the nations, and God shall decide disputes for many peoples. And then the verse they put up on the wall. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war anymore. Verse 5, O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. So they conveniently cut out all the parts about God and only put the parts in that seem to indicate that mankind at some point in time is going to be able to resolve his own issues. But it's not true. It's God that resolves all these issues. And so this is the end result, certainly, of Daniel's prophecy, and that the healing of the divided nations will happen by divine intervention through the Lord God. It's God's purpose that this world be a place of peace and justice where there is no more division, where swords will literally be converted into implements to grow vegetables and feed the nation, and it is God that will realize that plan, not the United Nations. We got to understand that. So it's God that will heal the divided nations. You know, I had Mike read Revelation 22 at the start, and we see one of the verses up here because it talks about the healing of the nations. It's God that will heal the divided nations. So you really want to save the world, believe in God, because he's the one that's going to do it. And when you ask yourself, what in the world is going on? Read the Bible. Because the Bible will tell you what's going on. And oftentimes it tells you the things that are going to happen while it's going on. And then tell other people about the truth of the Bible, because really we're supposed to be witnesses and watchmen for the things that are happening. And that's why we present these kind of talks from this kind of virtual platform. It's God that will heal the divided nations. We just need to watch the signs, and we will see that the events that God has laid out for us in the Bible are literally coming to pass before our very eyes. So I just want to close by reading this verse that's up on the screen, this vision of the healing of the nations from the book of Revelation, the last book in the Bible, and from chapter 22, which is the last chapter in the Bible. And it says, through the middle of the street of the city, also on either side of the river. So we have this vision of the kingdom of God. And here's the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And so I hope and I pray that this wasn't too shocking or this wasn't too depressing, but that it brings out to you the things that are happening in this world that we need to be aware of, that we need to understand the signs of, so that we can match the things that God has said with the things that are happening around us, and we can say, God said it would happen, and it is, and it's right. And so let's continue to ask what in the world is going on. Let's continue to be curious about the things that are happening in this world, and let's marry those things to the word of God so that our faith might be strengthened in these last days, and that we might endure to the end until the Lord Jesus Christ does return and these things actually happen, because he will, and because they will happen. Thank you.